Hey, it's Jen. Just a quick heads up before we start the show. The news is rapidly developing, and things may have changed by the time you hear this episode. For the latest news, tune into your public radio station and follow updates at npr.org. This is 1A. I'm Jen White in Washington. We finally have a third COVID vaccine option. Johnson & Johnson's one-shot vaccine has been approved for emergency use by the U.S. Food and Drug Administration and the Centers for Disease Control. How effective is this new option, and what might having it mean for when we can return to normal? Dr. Anthony Fauci is the nation's top infectious disease expert, and he's here to tell us more. Dr. Fauci, welcome back to 1A.
Thank you. Good to be with you.
So what do people need to know about this newest vaccine option?
Well, it's a highly efficacious vaccine. It's really very good news for the overall effort of containing this outbreak, both in the United States and globally, because now right here in the United States, we now have three highly efficacious, safe vaccines that we can now add to the armamentarium. So having a third one is very good news. It is a single shot vaccine. It does not have the strict cold chain requirements in the sense of requiring it to be frozen at a very, very low level. It can be kept in a refrigerator. There are some advantages to it. It's just good news having it available to us now. The first amount of doses will be relatively small, about 4 million that would be able to be distributed essentially imminently. As we get into March, which is now the first day, but as we get into March, there will be a total of 20 million. And by the time we get to the end of June, there'll be precisely 100 million doses that have been contracted.
Now, you mentioned the efficacy of this vaccine. We got an email from Kath who said she's holding out for one of the other two vaccines because she believes they're more effective than Johnson & Johnson's. What do you think?
Well, I see. I don't think that statement can be made accurately for the following reason. The only way you can say one is better than the other is if you test them head to head under the same identical circumstances. When we talk about efficacy, 72% in the United States is a high degree of efficacy. And you should not be getting involved in comparing numbers like this is a couple of percentage points or multiple percentage points better. All you need to know is it efficacious, and it's highly efficacious. A very important thing that people should realize that this vaccine was tested not only in the United States, but it was tested in Southern Africa and in South America. And in all of the locations, the protection against moderate to severe disease was over 85%, and there were no hospitalizations or deaths in individuals in the countries in which this was tested, namely people who have severe disease but were not hospitalized or died. So to have a vaccine that even under the circumstances of the variants, namely the mutated viruses that we see in Southern Africa, even under those circumstances, this vaccine prevented hospitalization and death is really good news. So I don't think we should be parsing numbers except to say we have three really good vaccines. I'll give you an example of the reality of that. I happen to have been vaccinated a bit ago with the Moderna vaccine, but if I were unvaccinated now and I went into a place that had vaccine and they said, you could take the J&J now, or you'd have to wait like a month to get one of the mRNA vaccines, I would take the J&J vaccine because the real goal is to get as many people vaccinated as quickly and as expeditiously as possible. So we really shouldn't be thinking in terms of one better than the other significantly. They're different, and they were never compared head to head.
We now have three vaccines, the Johnson & Johnson, the Moderna, and the third from Pfizer. We get a lot of questions about when we can expect to have one approved for children. What do we know about that?
Well, a couple of the companies, I know Pfizer has already gone down to 12 years old in their studies. there have been Moderna and Pfizer and other companies are going to be doing the following. Rather than go through each and every, let me get broadly what we can expect. We can expect that children of high school age will have been tested in clinical trials to the point where we would know that they were safe for them and that they induced the kind of immune response that was comparable to the response in adults, which we know protects them. That would likely be giving us the situation where children of high school age will likely be able to be vaccinated by the fall. Can't guarantee it's going to be the very first day of school in the fall, but it will be sometime in the fall. When you're dealing with children of the elementary school, what we do, because children are vulnerable and we want to make sure that safety above all is considered, you do what's called age de-escalation studies. So you start looking at it for safety and the type of immune response it induces in children from 12 to 9, then from 9 to 6, then from 6 to 2 years, and then from 6 months to 2 years. It's called age de-escalation because you don't just jump in and start vaccinating children who are 1, 2, 3, 4 years old. You start off with those who are older. Those studies will be likely completed by the end of this calendar year, and it is almost certain that we won't be able to get vaccine to children of elementary school age by the first quarter of 2022. So likely the studies will end by the end of 2021, and we likely will be able to vaccinate children of elementary school age in the very first quarter of 2022.
And Dr. Fauci, Mary Margaret from Little Rock has this question for you.
I'm a grandmother and a mom of a daughter who is 12 to 13 weeks pregnant. And I'm just really frustrated. I've been vaccinated and so has my husband. But the instructions given to these pregnant women is ask your doctor. My daughter is a elementary school teacher, so obviously is in Arkansas, the kids are in school. And so I'd like to hear from Dr. Fauci on what his recommendations are for these pregnant women. What, Dr. Fauci, do you tell them besides check with your doctor?
Dr. Fauci, I know you're not this young woman's doctor, but what advice do you have for pregnant people? Because we get this question quite a bit.
Well, I guess you have to clarify advice about what? What are they asking me? Should she go to work? Should she get vaccinated?
Specifically about vaccination. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So the situation is as follows. After the EUA, namely the emergency use authorization of the Moderna and the Pfizer trial, the mRNA, following that, during the clinical trial, it was an exclusion criteria if women were pregnant because we were waiting to do specifically trials in women to see if it were safe and if it induces the kind of response that's comparable to the response in adult non-pregnant individuals in the clinical trials. However, after the EUA was issued, thousands of pregnant women elected to get vaccinated with the mRNA vaccination. Many of them were women somewhat similar to the case that was just asked. They were either women who were in the healthcare profession where they might be exposed to patients who had COVID-19. And we know that getting infected with SARS-CoV-2 and getting COVID-19 is very deleterious to the mother and to the baby, ultimately. We're starting to see data now about that that we didn't have early on. So they've made the choices that any unknown risk, which is certainly very, very low of the vaccine, certainly is worth getting the benefit of the vaccine versus the risk of getting infected in reality, which could be very, very detrimental to the mother and to the fetus. So my recommendation would be, yes, you should go to your doctor. But if a situation was where my wife were pregnant and were being in a situation where she could be exposed either in the school or in the healthcare workplace, I would recommend that the risk of getting infected is certainly, in my mind, considerably greater than the risk of any problem you might have with the vaccine. Bottom line, I would tell her to get vaccinated.
There have been many dates talked about for when we can go back to quote unquote normal, including as soon as midsummer. How are you thinking about that timeline and what needs to happen to make it a reality?
Well, we've got to be careful about making predictions regarding timelines because we know that there are these variants that are circulating throughout the country in certain regions. We have a variant in California. We have a variant in New York, particularly in the New York City metropolitan area. We have the UK, the British variant, which is likely going to be dominant in our own country. So you want to get as many people vaccinated as quickly as you can. We're having a slope of infections that are going down very nicely. If they start to plateau, then predictions about when we're going to get back to normal really don't make any sense. If, in fact, we continue to go down and we successfully vaccinate the vast majority of the population, I would say 70 to 85%, I would think we would gradually approaching elements of normality, and we would be close to that as we get to the fall and winter, and namely the fall and end of this current year.
That's Dr. Anthony Fauci, director of the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases at the National Institutes of Health. Dr. Fauci, thanks for speaking with us.
You're quite welcome. Thank you for having me.
We have to take a quick break, but we'll continue discussing the recently approved Johnson & Johnson COVID-19 vaccine in a moment.
This message comes from NPR sponsor, Hint, fruit-infused water with no calories or sweeteners. Hint water comes in over 25 flavors. The watermelon water actually tastes like watermelon. The blackberry water tastes like blackberries. Hint is water with a touch of true fruit flavor. You can get Hint water at stores, or you can have it delivered directly to your door. When you buy two cases, you'll get a third case free and free shipping. Visit drinkhint.com and use promo code NPR at checkout.
The news is about more than what just happened. You need to know why it happened, who made it happen, how it's felt in the communities you care about. NPR's daily news podcast, Consider This, gives you all of that with context, backstory, and analysis on a single topic every weekday. It's not just information, it's what the news means. Consider This from NPR.
We're discussing the newly approved Johnson & Johnson COVID vaccine. This one is different from the Pfizer and Moderna vaccines already available. It doesn't need to be kept in a freezer, and it only requires one dose. What do you need to know about this new option? Here to tell us all about it is Dr. Haley Ganz. She's a member of the FDA's advisory committee reviewing COVID vaccines. She's also a clinical professor of pediatrics and infectious diseases at Stanford University. Dr. Ganz, welcome to 1A.
Thank you. It's wonderful to be here.
Also with us is Professor Maureen Farron, a virologist at Rochester Institute of Technology. Professor Farron, welcome.
Good morning, and thank you so much for inviting me to speak with you today.
So the Johnson & Johnson vaccine works a little differently than the Pfizer and Moderna vaccines, and our listener Colin is hoping you can explain it.
My name is Colin, and I'm from Elkton, Maryland. And I was wondering if you guys could go into detail and help us understand what the difference is between mRNA vaccines like Moderna and Pfizer and a viral vector vaccine like Johnson and Johnson's vaccine. I have a basic understanding of the distinction because my wife is a doctor of biochemistry, but I don't really understand it too well in any terms that I, can comprehend.
Okay, Professor Farron, I'm going to ask you to give us an explainer on how these different vaccines work.
Right, that's a really great and very important question. And so in general, we have many different types of vaccines that we use to protect people against viruses and bacteria. And in particular, as the caller said, Johnson & Johnson is what we call a viral vector vaccine. And so these types of vaccines really rely on the use of a safe virus that's somehow been crippled or modified where it can no longer cause disease. And we use this safe vector virus to deliver a bit of information against the virus that we're worried about. And so specifically for the Johnson & Johnson vaccine, that vaccine is based on an adenovirus, which usually causes the common cold. And so this virus has been crippled so that it can't cause any disease. And what they did instead is they put a bit of the SARS-CoV-2 genetic information into this modified adenovirus. And then the idea is that this adenovirus is made, and basically when you get the vaccine, that syringe is filled with this modified adenovirus. And when it's injected into somebody's arm, the hope is that the virus will deliver this bit of genetic information, and then those cells will start to make the spike protein, or that so-called outside surface protein of SARS-CoV-2. And then hopefully the immune system will recognize this protein as foreign and start to make some antibodies and to activate other really important immune cells that would then protect that person if they were ever to be exposed to SARS-CoV-2 again in the future.
We did a long hour on the mRNA vaccines, explaining how that science works, and you can find that at the 1A.org. Dr. Ganz, you're on the FDA panel that voted unanimously to recommend the Johnson & Johnson vaccine for emergency use. As part of that, you read a lot of research on how it works. What do you think people need to know about this new vaccine?
Yeah, thank you for that important question, the opportunity to speak about the new vaccine that's available to us all. It's a great day. We were able to look at all of the ways in which this vaccine first was researched and brought to this platform, and then we were able to look at all of the studies that brought it to into humans, and then we were able actually to look at how it did in humans. So there was a lot of work coming up to the point at which the FDA was allowed to analyze all the data. It's a platform that has been used elsewhere, and also there's a lot of experience. So this, again, is not new, just like the mRNA vaccines that were previously authorized. They also had been studied for quite some time. The data that we had available to us showed that it was, as Dr. Fauci has discussed, very efficacious. And we saw that data. We saw the type of immune system that was just discussed that was elicited by this particular vaccine. And we also were able to look at the safety profile. So we looked at all of the adverse events that occurred.
We got this question from Tony in Tennessee about the vaccine's effectiveness.
The J&J vaccines are reported to be around 85% effective. And the original ones that came out were in the 90-95 range. My question is, what is the lowest percentage that a vaccine can be and still be effective?
Professor Farron?
So that's a really great question. And I believe it really depends on the virus that we're trying to vaccinate against. There's a pretty big spectrum of efficacy when we look across the different vaccines that we use. But for a virus where you're in the middle of a pandemic, I think 85% is very, very good news. And it's a fantastic addition to our arsenal against the SARS-CoV-2 virus.
We do have a lot of people asking if the Johnson & Johnson vaccine is less effective than Moderna or Pfizer. Can you give us more context to the varying results?
Right. And so this is a really important point. And I think as Dr. Fauci really carefully pointed out, in order to really compare Moderna directly to Pfizer, directly to Johnson & Johnson, these studies would have been done, had to have been done head-to-head, directly compare these vaccines under the exact same conditions, in the same populations, with all of the conditions being kept as similar as possible. And that is absolutely not what has been done. These vaccines have been well-tested and well-tried, but the end result that the different companies were looking at varied. The way the vaccine trials were conducted varied. When they were conducted really varied. So, for example, the mRNA vaccines, as Dr. Fauci said, were primarily approved before we had all these variants circulating. And in contrast, the Johnson & Johnson vaccine has been really tested in a world where these variants are circulating. And yet, overall, it has very high efficacy. And also importantly, it provided, at least in the clinical trials, 100% protection against serious disease and death. So I think that's really an important point. I don't think at this point we can honestly say which vaccine is going to perform better in the long run as we move through this pandemic.
Dr. Ganz, explain a little bit more about the kinds of things the FDA panel looked at when evaluating the Johnson & Johnson vaccine.
I couldn't agree more with Dr. Farron that the important correlates and what we were looking at when we looked at the data is the real important way that this was studied and that it was highly efficacious and almost 100% for hospitalizations and severe disease. Just to give a perspective for our audience, as already was mentioned, many of the vaccines that we use are really targeted at the most severe outcomes, not against just mild infection, so influenza, other vaccines, the chickenpox vaccine. So this one came into that same context where we were really trying to prevent the outcomes that are important for people and also obviously important for our public health sector. So importantly for individuals who get this vaccine, they were protected against the outcomes that are most important. So severe disease, which can obviously have long-term sequelae or outcomes that you don't want. And also obviously we don't want to lose anyone from this virus. So we were analyzing that as we were looking at that. Also importantly, as was already mentioned, was the idea that these were tested in areas where we know that the virus has become more transmissible. So as any virus would change from one species to another, it learns how to actually infect that new species more effectively, and that's what's happening with this virus as well. So all in all, the data that we looked at for all of the ways in which this particular vaccine works were very encouraging.
Here's what Elizabeth from Michigan wants to know.
If the efficacy rate for the Johnson & Johnson vaccine is less than 90%, then how can the FDA approve it? And also, why don't they just make it a two-dose vaccine like the Pfizer and Moderna ones that have like 95% efficacy rates?
So Dr. Ganz, this is a good time to remind folks that the Johnson & Johnson vaccine is a single shot. Explain why that is and whether there might be a need for boosters down the line.
Yeah, thank you again to your audience member. This is a very important point to highlight at this time. So the way that the other vaccines were studied that were authorized previously, if we've talked about the Pfizer and Moderna, they were studied as two doses. So the option to then deliver them as two doses is what we had before us. This particular one, and this is how science works, we learn as we go, they looked at a single dose and they looked at two doses. So in the pre-studies, the immune responses were equivalent to that. So again, when you are challenging your body, you're trying to look at what is the immune response. And so because they were equivalent, this is really, really important that then what you want to do is be able to provide a vaccine in the situation that we're in that actually could be highly effective and the people don't have to come back and get a second immunization and they don't have to wait that period of time after that is efficacious.
I just want to make sure I'm clear. They studied the Johnson & Johnson vaccine with two shots and also with a single shot. And what they found was the efficacy was the same with two shots and one shot. Is that correct?
So they didn't look at efficacy. What they did look at was the immune response.
Okay.
So in the early studies, when you're trying to understand how your vaccine is going to work, you do look at different responses of your body. So in the preliminary studies, they did do these two different head-to-head trial, head-to-head immune studies. And so they did show that those two mechanisms, so one dose and two doses, gave you the same immune response. There was no reason to think that they would function differently. And so they brought the one dose forward because of the immune response that they saw to that. I will say that it's highly efficacious, as everyone has said, and we're very excited about it. And it has a huge role in getting us to herd immunity.
So is it likely there'll be a future booster shot for the Johnson & Johnson vaccine?
Right. So there are ongoing studies, actually, with the two doses. And that is something that may be what we have to do in the future. We're not sure yet. We don't know if it is a better method or strategy for this particular vaccine, but that is being studied, and we will have more information on that when people need to know that they would need a further additional vaccine dose.
Professor Farron, Rosalind emailed this. If a booster is needed in the future, will we need to get a booster from the vaccine we originally received? I got the Moderna, so will I have to get only a Moderna booster? What do we know about this?
So that's a really great question. And as Dr. Gaines said, there are many ongoing studies. So these three vaccines have been approved according to the dosage regime that they were studied in. But now these companies are really going back and looking at other dosage suggestions. So, for example, I know Moderna and Pfizer are certainly looking at doing real trial studies about could they do just one shot? Is the second shot really necessary? And certainly Johnson & Johnson is looking at what the outcome would be if they were to give a second shot. And in terms of right now, if I had Moderna, right now the recommendation is that yes, you should go back and get the second shot or booster as a Moderna. But there are also studies being done right now to see if you could have Moderna, and then if Pfizer were to be available, could you have your second booster be a Pfizer vaccine? But I don't think those trials have been conducted yet. Perhaps Dr. Gaines knows more about how the progress on these other studies are going.
Dr. Gaines, can you share that with us?
Yeah, thank you. Dr. Farron is exactly right. It's too early to understand all the different ways in which these function. So I would be in 100% agreement that right now we would recommend that you stick with the vaccine that you actually had, but we will know more moving forward. We haven't started those studies yet. But there are a lot of issues that we're still learning from all of these vaccines. And right now, the recommendation is to use them as they were studied currently.
And Dr. Gaines, very briefly, once you get the Johnson & Johnson vaccine, if that's the vaccine you receive, how quickly does it become effective?
Yeah, that's a really great question. So the first time you're exposed to any new infection, it takes about 10 days to 2 weeks to actually mount a really good immune response. And that's where we start seeing the individuals in the placebo start falling away from those individuals in the vaccine in terms of efficacy. It's about 14 days after. But the interesting immune correlate about this particular vaccine is actually your immune response appears to get stronger and stronger as time goes on. And the efficacy appears to, for instance, in the later time points, be 100%.
We're discussing the newly approved Johnson & Johnson vaccine. We'll hear more from you and our guests in a moment.
Support for NPR and the following message come from BetterHelp, offering online counseling. BetterHelp therapist Hesu Jo knows that lockdown has been hard on us as humans.
We as people are hardwired to connect with others, which is why this whole time is so difficult. The connection that happens between people can be very powerful, and how healing it can be to have a healthy relationship with someone.
To get matched with a counselor within 48 hours and save 10%, go to betterhelp.com/1A.
When the survivors of a mass shooting at a newspaper went back to work, everything was different, even email.
What if someone's sending us more death threats? Or what if somebody sends me a death threat and I don't see it, and then somebody comes and kills all my friends and it's my fault because I didn't read the email?
That's this week on the Capital Gazette series from NPR's Embedded.
We're discussing the Johnson & Johnson COVID-19 vaccine. It was recently approved for emergency use. Let's jump back into the conversation. Now, Dr. Ganz, the FDA advisory panel you're on also approved the Moderna and Pfizer vaccines for emergency use at the end of last year. What more have we learned about those vaccines since?
Yeah, this was a great opportunity. We had met previously also in October to give the companies and also the CDC and FDA information about what we would want to see moving forward. And so we actually heard at the meeting on Friday the update after 55 million doses have already been administered of both of those vaccines that you mentioned, the Pfizer and the Moderna, so together. And we were able to actually hear about the safety outcomes that have been tracked during this period of time. So there's a number of different mechanisms in which we have in place. One of them is really real time, which looks at all of the million doses and selected. There's about 15 different adverse outcomes that are actually looked at, and they're looked at in the vaccine group compared to the whole population to get a baseline rate. And there was no signal there for any safety issues related to that. There's also this really using technology, which there's an app that people who get vaccinated can use, and there's about 4 million people who actually are using it and are able to give us real-time information about what they're experiencing when they get the vaccine. We have that data as well. And all of the adverse events that were recorded there and elsewhere are really consistent with what we saw when we heard the report initially in December of this year. So similar, nothing new, no increase in signal that we were worried about. There's also a vaccine reporting system that has been in place and also reviewed. So we learned a lot about the safety of these vaccines and millions of doses given, which is really impactful information, and also allows us on the committee to understand our work and how it puts into context then the safety of these other vaccines that come into play.
Professor Fearon, we got this email from Karen who asks, would people getting the J&J vaccine help prevent the virus from developing more mutations?
Right, and this is another key point to why it's such wonderful news that we now have three separate vaccines. And it's also great that we have vaccines that give people immunity based on different platforms or diversity within these vaccines. Because the hope really is we need to get as many people as possible vaccinated as quickly as possible. Because if you can limit the virus from replicating in the population, you're also limiting the virus's ability to mutate or vary and come up with these variants that then you have to go back and determine whether or not the vaccines really are protective against. Thankfully, it does look like the vaccines, it's a spectrum, but they do maintain efficacy against most of the variants. The South African variant is a bit of a problem in that regard. But you really want to tamp down that virus from replicating as fast as possible so that you don't come up with these variants.
Professor Fearon, we got this email from Carolyn who says, when answering a recent question, the guest made a distinction between immune response and efficacy. What's the difference?
And so this is something Dr. Ganz might be better able to speak to, but when you think about mounting an immune response, that can mean a variety of different things. It could be somebody in a research lab, you get a vaccine, and then you go in, for example, if you're a trial patient, and they go in and they draw blood and they can look for antibody levels. They can look for activation of other kinds of immune signals, but the efficacy really has to do with in the street, kind of protecting people against getting that illness. So it's quite a different measure.
Dr. Ganz, anything to add there?
Yeah, I think that that's a really important point. And what we try and do then is link what we're seeing in the laboratory, so the immune response, to the ability of a particular pathogen, whether it's a bacteria or a virus, to how it can stop that disease. So the immune system responds in a certain way. If we can understand that, then we have what's called immune correlates of protection, and then we don't have to wait for a event to happen in order to understand it in other populations. This is very, very important for how we're going to look at this in new populations such as children moving forward.
Well, Antonio called us with a question about the vaccine and COVID long haulers.
My question is, how good is it at preventing the symptoms of the long haulers? They're having reported people that they keep having COVID symptoms even months after they have recovered. How good is the Johnson & Johnson vaccine at preventing this? Because, yeah, you probably don't die, but your quality of life might be diminished with those lingering symptoms. So how good is the Johnson & Johnson vaccine at preventing this if it's only 66% effective at preventing moderate to severe COVID symptoms?
Dr. Gans, what do we know about this?
Yeah, well, this is going to be an important way in which we're going to be following all these events moving forward. So, you know, this is one of the scientific questions that remains. What we think in general and what we know from the decades of experience that we have with vaccines is that a vaccine which provides even partial protection, so you have some, again, immune response in place, also protects you against disease outcomes. So it doesn't allow the virus or bacteria to really replicate, particularly viruses, replicate in your body. So you don't have all that damage that you can have in a typical situation where you have natural disease. So even if you were to get sick, we don't anticipate that actually meaning that you would have any of the long-term outcomes that you would have if even in a partial response than you would have from natural disease. So we do feel like, and what we understand from other vaccines is these are highly protective against also any kinds of poor outcomes that you get from having the natural disease. We've seen that with measles vaccine. We've seen that with the chickenpox vaccine. So that is our anticipation for this vaccine, all these vaccines, for the SARS-CoV-2, which causes the COVID disease. We don't anticipate that people would have ongoing issues.
We got this tweet from Lisa who says, why another vaccine? Why wasn't production shifted to produce as many vaccines as possible when the first one or two were approved? All manufacturers producing the one or two. Professor Farron, what do you think?
Yeah, that's a really interesting question, and several people have asked me that. And again, I think it's really important to have, first of all, we weren't sure back in the beginning which vaccine would be successful versus another. And so it was really important to have a number of different types of vaccines in the process. And also, as we see now, we have these three, and they're not the same, they're not identical, and that's really key. And for example, this Johnson & Johnson vaccine, it's a one-shot vaccine, as we've said. The conditions that it needs to be shipped and stored under are much easier compared to the mRNA vaccines. And so these factors really are going to enable us to vaccinate a greater number of people very, very rapidly. And so I think it's always great to have diversity in any approach. And I think that's true particularly and the same as when you're thinking about what kind of vaccines do you want to have out there, particularly in a pandemic situation where you're just trying to get it under control as soon as possible.
Catherine emailed us this question. It's a question we've been getting quite a bit. I had both doses of Pfizer but had no reaction. Does this mean it didn't take? Professor Farron?
That's a great question. And you know, I was fortunate too. I had I just got my second dose of the Pfizer vaccine. And other than having a sore arm, I was really very fortunate. I didn't suffer any even low-grade fevers or anything. And so people have a variation in terms of their responses to a vaccine. And sometimes people will get a low-grade fever, kind of feel malaise, a little bit tired. And that is actually a great sign that your immune system, we call it the innate immune system, is making a response. But if your body doesn't have any kind of negative response, it doesn't correlate with not being successfully vaccinated. It just seems to be, it varies from person to person.
Well, Michael tweeted us this question. Where do things stand today with studying the three currently authorized vaccines on teens and younger children?
Yeah, absolutely. And so I think as Dr. Fauci said, We are now going to go, and these companies are doing trials looking at younger individuals. And again, the Pfizer vaccine is now looked at in studies for children 12 years of age and older. And so hopefully that will come through the sort of recommendation pike soon and be approved for use in younger individuals. And he suggested that many of these trials, again, without going through vaccine by vaccine, are being tested in high school children, because we do see a problem, particularly with younger, I guess, young adults in that age category, because it's harder to contain them and keep them under quarantine. I have a 16-year-old, and I can promise that that's true. Mm. So it would be really fantastic to have a vaccine that we could give to people of young adult age that would be protective. But you don't just start giving vaccines to younger people until it's gone through the appropriate trial process. And that's really key here. And so hopefully that might be approved by the fall. And then they're going to go into younger children, which requires quite a different approach because you're getting into younger children that have a more fragile immune response.
Dr. Gans, where does this data stand right now on pregnant people, breastfeeding people, when it comes to the vaccine?
Yeah, thank you for that. I just wanted to add a quick note to Dr. Farron, who very adequately answered the previous question. I just did want to note that the Pfizer vaccine has already stopped enrolling in down to 12 years of age. So they're actually done with that study. So we hope to have that come before the FDA this spring. So that's exciting to us. And hopefully other ones will follow very quickly. The same issue with pregnant women and breastfeeding women. There are ongoing studies that are now currently enrolling in those. But the good news is that we actually have the current vaccines are being used in these populations. And so we do have a registry that actually is looking at all of the women who are getting it, who are in those categories, particularly pregnancy. The breastfeeding isn't being followed as closely. And we did review some of that data on Friday at our advisory committee, and that also looked very good. So there's a lot of ways in which we're looking at this in different populations, because the current vaccines are not restricted for use in those populations. So we have the opportunity to study them moving forward.
Professor Farron, we got this email from Cindy who says, while supplies are low, would it make any sense to target the Johnson & Johnson vaccine for the people least likely to be in the same place for two doses? I'm thinking of homeless people, migrant workers, folks coming through the border, maybe people in local jails. Your thoughts?
Certainly, people are thinking about trying to target different types of vaccines to different populations, and certainly the vaccines that need to have very specific super cold storage are going to be available at places where those types of facilities are available. And certainly you can imagine it would be advantageous to target different vaccines to populations based on their availability. I don't know at this point if that's something that people are actually doing, but it certainly would be something that I would imagine people are looking at. Dr. Gaines, do you know more?
Yeah, thank you. I think you're exactly right. These are the conversations that we have with all the vaccines as their limited supply. Who is the best group to get these vaccines? And there's a lot of questions about, of course, equity and trying to get these to the people who are at highest risk for disease, highest risk for the worst outcomes. And so it's very important for us to think about these populations, as Dr. Farron suggested.
Dr. Gans, many countries are also using the AstraZeneca vaccine, which works similarly to the Johnson & Johnson option, but it's not approved in the U.S. What's the holdup there?
Yeah, this is important. The AstraZeneca has not submitted anything to the FDA as of now. There was a hold when they were in their clinical trials, which then we kept on hold in the U.S. because the FDA was reviewing the patient and the considerations that were before us. And so the hold lasted a little longer in the U.S. because we have different agencies that look at this and different ability to authorize these. So they have not submitted. It will probably be coming soon there's continuous conversations with the FDA and AstraZeneca.
That was Dr. Haley Ganz. She's a member of the FDA's advisory committee reviewing COVID vaccines, and she's a clinical professor of pediatrics and infectious diseases at Stanford University. Also with us, Professor Maureen Farron, a virologist at the Rochester Institute of Technology. Professor Farron, Dr. Ganz, thanks to you both. Today's producer was Amanda Williams. Our podcast is produced by Barb Anguiano. This program comes to you from WAMU.